Norm Shealy. You are listening to Infinite Consciousness, your infinite access to the world
of the mind.
This is Eva Herr, and tonight we have Dr. Bernie Siegel, and we're going to talk about, among other things, his new book, 365 Prescriptions for the Soul, and 1,001 Other Questions. How are you, Dr. Siegel?
Well, I tell people never to ask me that, but if you want the standard answer, I'm okay. Probably better than most, despite all the difficulties life presents us with.
Well, typically, I would say I want the real answer, and tell me how you deal with those things when you struggle.
Well, but I've been counseling people for 30 years, you know, with life-threatening illnesses. So, you know, I know that I have the power, in a sense, to decide what I will think and feel. And so I keep working at it. But as I share with people, you know, life is difficult. It's not unfair. We all have our troubles. And, you know, we're all wounded. But it's what you do with your wounds that really your life amounts to.
Well, before we get started, I'm going to come back to that statement in just a second. Please tell people a little bit about yourself, how you came to where you are, and where to find you.
Well, the best way to find me and communicate with me is through my website, Bernie Siegel, S-I-E-G-E-L, M-D.com. And I'll answer them, you know, if they want to discuss something with me. But if they're interested in articles I've written, they're there. All my audio, you know, discussions, meditations, and all the books I've written, everything's listed there. So that's another thing they can get in order if they're interested. What got me where I am was several things. One, and I always say I come from a minority group because my parents loved me. I did well in school, and I got along with God. So I'm a multiple personality who isn't afraid of the world and about relationships and what people think, because I didn't experience abuse and rejection and indifference, which I think the majority of the world does grow up with, and that's something we can talk about too. But I was an artist as a child. I didn't know you could earn a living as an artist. That may sound crazy, but I had no idea of art as something you sold. It was just something that interested me. So I thought, you have good hands, you like science, you like fixing things, and you like people, so become a surgeon. So I did that. The problem, of course, was you suddenly realize you can't fix everything, that this is a painful world. People die. And you really begin to get into a lot of spiritual questions that are never answered in medical school. You know, why does God make a world? Because I did a lot of children's surgery where children have cancer and all kinds of problems. You know, those are things that really were troubling me as an individual and, as I say, weren't dealt with at the hospital or at medical meetings. You know, there you were always in your head classifying things, not discussing feelings. So I went to a workshop that was about how to help cancer patients. And I thought it was, you know, going to be filled with doctors. And there were two psychotherapists, myself and 125 patients there. And then I was sitting with my patients, seeing no desk, which I learned to put against the wall, so I wasn't separated from patients. But here we were together. And one of them sat next to me, a young woman with breast cancer, and these were her words. She said, "You're a nice guy. I feel better when I'm in the office with you, but I can't take you home with me, so I need to know how to live between office visits." That's when I went back to the office and sent out letters to start a support group. It ended up being labeled Exceptional Cancer Patients because my wife came up with that name. We were both shocked by how few people answered. You send 100 letters to people with cancer from your doctor, and it says, "You want to live a longer, better life? Come to a meeting." I'm in a panic thinking 300 to 500 people will show up, bringing, you know, friends, relatives, and everybody else who has problems. And less than a dozen women showed up.
Really?
I realized I don't know my patients and what they're going through and their attitude. And I'd say the bottom line was, what I also learned was what Solzhenitsyn talks about in his book, Cancer War, there are cases of self-induced healing. And, you know, when people suddenly start healing their lives, see, not battling cancer and trying to kill their disease, but how can I heal my life? how can I start doing what feels right for me now that I know I'm here for a limited time? And I noticed that people didn't die when they were supposed to, when they really began enjoying their life. And so that's what I began to preach 20 and 30 years ago, and got into all kinds of trouble because when I would say to a patient, what's happened in your life in the last year or two? Oh, you're blaming the patient. I mean, believe me, I was on all the famous talk shows with doctors arguing with me. Today, research and science has shown how loneliness, laughter, relationships, all these things, even having a dog, all these things affect immune function and survival. So now it's scientific, and I don't get, on all the famous talk shows and get into arguments with people.
What happened in your life? Did you have some kind of spiritual epiphany or something when you were young? Most doctors, even though they see all these things, they still don't get it. What happened that
Well, I think it had really to do. Yeah, I'd say there are several things that I never thought about as, consciously as affecting me. But number one was my mother had hyperthyroidism, weighed practically nothing, was told not to become pregnant because it could threaten her life, did, and had all kinds of complications, was told she couldn't survive a cesarean section. So after endless number of days in labor, they said, we have to get the kid out of there. So they yanked me out. And this is a quote from my mother. They didn't hand me a child. They handed me a purple melon. And that is due to the hemorrhages that from my constant battering. So she had this, unrecognizable thing that she took home. And again, to quote my mother, we wrapped you in kerchiefs, put you in a carriage, covered it, and hid you behind the house. When I heard this as an adult, because I never heard this story, and if you look in a family album and see a covered carriage, you assume I'm sleeping, and my mother's standing next to it smiling, you don't know what's in the carriage. But I said to her, why am I not a drug addict or an alcoholic? And this is something that really struck me. I had what the ugly duckling never had. I had a grandmother, and she rescued me. And to quote my mother, took you and poured oil all over you and then pushed everything back where it belonged 4 and 5 times a day. So I went to getting massaged 4 and 5 times a day by someone who loved me. And what a switch, say, and what a stimulation to the child. So I grew up with love from day one. At age 4, I almost choked to death and had an out-of-body experience and was mad as hell when I mean, this sounds crazy to say that, but when you're 4 years old and you're choking to death on a toy you've aspirated, it is no fun. I can still feel what it's like to try to breathe when no air will pass through your larynx. And I left my body, and it was total pleasure. I was, enthralled with it, sad that my parents would find me dead. But I can remember thinking, this is what I would choose. I don't want to go back. Now, it never occurred to me when you're 4 years old, how can you see? I'm used to seeing. How can you see when you're out of your body? How can you think? But blind people born blind who have a near-death experience, see when they leave their body. So I've learned that we're perfect again when we get tired of our bodies and leave. Death is not the worst outcome. So there was another experience. So I think these things at a conscious and unconscious level, probably more unconsciously, affected me as I went through life. And as I said, my grandfather was my religious teacher. So I was never stuck in all kinds of, he grew up as an Orthodox Jew in Russia teaching and left there because his life was threatened because of his religion. But he and I would sit in the evening and go over our religion. So I wasn't stuck on all kinds of rituals. And to me, God was a friendly person, who spoke through my grandfather. And as I said, I did well in school. So I didn't have all the problems, the majority of other people had. I got excellent grades, won scholarships, and, skipped a couple of years in school. So I just went forward and followed. And the other thing, let me finish with this, that I would ask people, what mottos do you live by? And a man said to me one day, you didn't ask us what mottos we're dying by, what our parents said to us. So the three things I grew up with were, number one, if you had feelings, say, and didn't know what to do, my mother's answer to every question was, do what'll make you happy. And, okay, you know, where do you go to school? Which girl should I take out? It didn't matter. If I asked my mother, got the same answer. Do what'll make you happy. So she forced me to ask myself, what feels right? Stop thinking. When you had a problem, and this drove me nuts as a teenager, I'd come home having a disastrous day, say to my mother, Ma, I had a horrible day. Oh, it was meant to be. God is redirecting you. Something good will come of this. That drove me nuts. But it led me to go to my bedroom and talk to God. And the third thing, my father's father died when he was 12. So, and they could hardly survive. His father had tuberculosis, no insurance, etc. And so his comment was, money is to help make the world an easier place to live in. It's not about accumulating things and owning things. It's about helping people. And so, you know, when you grow up with those messages, you are a different person, because every child is hypnotized by the authority figures in their life up to the age of 6. I mean, your brainwave pattern. So, you know, what you're hearing in those years is literally hypnotic. And for me, the hypnotic aspects were productive and therapeutic and helped me to survive versus what other people are hearing about how you're a failure and you embarrass us and we never wanted you. And it, and quote, I mean, I don't make up these lines. We don't love you enough to not commit suicide. That's from the parents to their child. And you know, it goes on. And I hear from people, my mother's words were eating away at me and maybe gave me cancer. So, you know, the headlines that we're seeing today where people, you know, the guy who walks into a gym and shoots women because no woman has been nice to him, or the kid goes to school and kills his schoolmates and his teachers. That's about indifference, rejection, and abuse, and the desire for revenge, and then the guilt, because you notice most of them end up killing themselves too. And it, if we all grew up with love, what a different world it would be, because then the relationships are not something to fear and not something that causes pain. They're something to enjoy.
So what is God to you today? Is it? I want to know what that. I want to know that answer, and I want to know, because I'm interested in consciousness. God to you, it's the same for me. But what is consciousness to you?
Consciousness is what continues to survive after the body dies. It's a part of us. And three things have convinced me of it. Okay, that consciousness is a non-local event. It doesn't just stay in your body. It affects those around you. Even studies with doctors who have a nasty attitude walk into a room and it affects the outcome of the patient. And the patient doesn't understand why, but they're sensing that consciousness. But what convinced me, and I'll share some experiences I had before this, a friend of mine named Amelia Kincaid, she's written books, the one that this story is in, became a foreword, is Straight from the Horse's Mouth. Now, Amelia, I met her in San Francisco at a Nun-Kill conference for the ASPCA. I was one of the speakers. I met her in the elevator. And when she said she was an animal intuitive, I thought, that's nuts. How can you talk to animals? But what happens? And we've always had a house full and a yard full of animals. We don't live on a farm, but we've had everything from goats to snakes. I mean, living in and around our house. And I said to her one day when I came home, was watching our son's house, and one of his cats disappeared. An indoor cat, somebody left the door open, the cat's gone. I said to Amelia, I'm in Connecticut, she's in Los Angeles, California. I said, Amelia, okay, where's the cat? Without even a photograph, which she asked for from clients. A few days later, I get an email. Bernie, the cat is alive. I can see the moon through its eyes. Then she went into incredible detail about the house. There were two other dogs, two other cats, she said, are frightening this animal. Described them, the colors, what their fur was like, the garbage cans, the pine cones. I mean, it went on. That was utterly unbelievable. The next morning, I went over there, called the cat's name, because the one thing that confused me, she said, the cat's under the house, and that made no sense. How do you get under a house? But turns out the house is on a little hill, and there's a stairway that comes down and the sides of the stairway are wooden and come down to the ground, and the cat was under the stairway. And after calling her name for several minutes, she cried out, and I went and picked her out. That's number one. Number two is that I hear voices. When I get into, like, taking a walk, you know, running, biking, so usually it's a rhythmic, you know, physical action.
I hear voices. I know exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah. And one, again, just an example. Well, two examples. One, the day I knew my father was going to die, I went out running before going to the hospital, and a voice said, "How did your parents meet?" I have no idea. So I said, "I don't know." And the voice said, "Then ask your mother when you get to the hospital." And so when I walk in, and again, the voice then seems to speak through me, because I walk in the room, and I don't get a chance to say, "I'm sorry, let me hug you, I love you." I walked in the room and immediately said, "Mom, how did you two meet?" And the end of the story was that their first date was because my father lost a coin toss and had to take my mother out. Well, everybody in the room started laughing as my mother's stories went on, and my father died laughing, looking wonderful. Again, you talk about consciousness. When did he die? There are grandchildren, great-grandchildren coming from all over the country. He has no idea he's in a coma, who's coming from where. But when the last grandchild arrived and was announced, he took his last breath and died with a big smile on his face. The other, not too long ago, got to share this one too. I wrote a book called Buddy's Candle. It's to help people who have loss of a loved one, be it an animal. I mean, it's written in the style of a children's book with pictures and about an animal who dies. But it's for anyone who loses a loved one. It helps you not grieve in an unhealthy way. But I write the book. I'm taking our other dog out for a walk, and a voice said, "Go to the animal shelter." So I immediately jump in the car, drive to the shelter. I walk in the door, and again, the voice said, "I see a dog sitting in somebody's lap." And I said, "What's his name?" Now, I have to tell people that I go to the animal shelter a lot because we're always rescuing creatures and bringing them home with me. So I don't walk in and ask what a dog's name is. I say hello to people, what's going on, but again, the voice takes over. I walked in, and I said, "What's his name?" And the person who was holding him said, "His name is Buddy. He's been here for less than 15 minutes. Lady doesn't like his behavior, so she brought him here." I said, "I'm here to take him home." And I did, and he's in my house now. But those are the kinds of things that happen to me, hearing voices. And last but not least, which totally convinces me of the survival of consciousness. See, we talk about past lives. I think my definition of a past life is that you are born with the awareness, the consciousness of those who have preceded you. That's why you know what has gone on. And some fascinating stories, you know, people, you know, and parents don't believe their child and what their child is telling them, and they go look it up in the newspaper, and they find out the child is telling them an accurate story about how he died in a past life, you know, in an auto accident. Now, I'm on the phone with a friend, and when she learned how busy I was, she said, "Bernie, why are you living this life?" Now, what was her intention? To get me to slow down. But after she said, "Why are you living this life?" I went into a trance, and I'm sitting on the phone, you know, not in a therapist's office having regression therapy. I'm listening to a friend on the phone, and I went into a trance. And the first thing I saw was myself with a sword in my hand. And I said to her immediately, "You know, maybe that's why I'm a surgeon. I killed people in a past life with a sword." And then we went on with our conversation, which distracted me from the images. And about 2 weeks later, I, again, spontaneously, while sitting in an airplane just staring out the window, went into a trance. And it was like watching a movie. I'm the audience, and I'm the actor. And I saw myself as a knight years ago, I believe in Ireland, because of other things in my life, where I killed and learned from that about faith and about a lot of things. Because one of the things that always bothered me is how Abraham, or Jesus for that matter, or Noah, could accept what God told them. You know, Noah not asking for God to save a few more people, Abraham not arguing and saying, take me, not my son, and Jesus not jumping off the cross to impress everybody. So I have learned a lot about faith, and that what I did was to hurt a lot of people. And if you want to know the details of the story later, I can tell them to you, because it was incredibly moving and emotional event for me. I cried for hours, hours and hours.
Yeah, I'd like to know. We have more time tonight that we don't normally have
for
some reason.
Well, what happened was, and this is how I told the story to James Hillman, because it really, I needed help. He's a Jungian therapist, happened to live in Connecticut. I realized that, called him. He said, fine, come over. I said to him, the Lord, my Lord, asks me to kill the neighbor's daughter because he's encroaching on their property. He won't listen. And I said to my Lord, why don't I kill him, not the daughter? He said, look, I'm asking you to kill the daughter. I said, what if I don't? He said, then I'll kill you. I said, okay, I'm going. So I go. I don't want to know this woman because it'll be more painful for me to kill her. And so we get there. I get to know she has a big dog, and I feed him and get to be friends with him. Learn where she lives, I mean, what room in the castle she's in. And I tell them that I'm a stranger. Do you mind if I stay here a few days? I'm, traveling. So they are nice to me. When I learn the room that she's in, I go up to it at night because I want to kill her in her sleep so it won't hurt. I walk in to the room. The dog is lying there, and he gets up and growls. So I pick up my sword and split his head open so he won't cause trouble. But his howl and the noise awakens the woman, and she turns and looks at me, and it was my wife's face, and I chopped her head off and went on crying and crying for 4 to 6 hours. It was just uncontrollable. When I brought the head back to my Lord, I said, okay, you happy now? He said, I didn't decide to do this. You did. You don't understand. If you'd had faith in me, what would have happened? And that's when I went to talk to Hillman and say, what's going on? And he said, you have to relive the experience and see what happens. So I do. And when my Lord says, kill the neighbor's daughter, I say, okay, fine, no problem. And he said, wait, now that I know you have faith in me, I don't want you to kill her. I want you to bring them here, convince them that I will not hurt them. We need to talk. And I go and talk to this young woman and tell her that she can trust me, and the father overhears, and he says, all right, I believe you, we'll go. And I stand in front of them to protect them. And when my Lord says, what are you doing standing in front of them? I need to talk. I said, I want to protect them so they know. And he said, move to the side. He said, I can also see something, that you and this young lady really care about each other. So I'll tell you how we're going to solve our problem. The two of you will get married, and you will take the land that we're fighting over as a wedding present. And that was the end. And the other thing that Hillman said to me was, Bernie, you keep saying the Lord, your Lord. I said, yeah, it's the Lord of the castle. He said, Bernie, it's more than that. And that's when it all flashed back to Abraham and Jesus and Noah and all these questions I've had for years. And, another thing that helped me was, I often say to people, if you could be God for a day, why would you want to be God? Almost everybody's going to fix something. You know, I mean, people have literally answered everything from the weather, you know, to stopping wars and so forth. But the right answer, which came from the Baal Shem Tov, who was watching Jews being slaughtered in Russia, and he said, I wish I were God. And when his students said to him, oh, you'd stop that? He said, no, but I'd understand why. And to me, that's what my life has been about. I needed to understand why. And that a perfect world is not creation. It's a magic trick. Because I always tell people I'm on the board of directors of heaven as a consultant, so I can talk to God. But really, we are not prepared for perfection as people. I mean that. If we had a perfect world right now, in 2 or 3 weeks, everybody would be complaining about everything. The weather and this and that, and nothing changes and it's boring. We need to create that kind of a world through our compassion and love for one another. Because I always say, as a surgeon, we're all the same color inside. You know, we're all one family, and our differences shouldn't be for persecution. they should be for recognition.
Did this all come to you in an instant, or is this something that took
some
time? Oh,
no, this was a lot over my lifetime.
Okay. I mean, that vision that you had, or
yeah,
whatever it was.
See, even out of the body, in near death, I mean, I didn't believe a lot of these things. Brian Weiss was a medical student at Yale. You know,
mm-hmm,
he's a psychiatrist who's written a lot about many lives, many masters, past lives. And I would say to him, it's nonsense. I can't believe it. He'd say, what are you talking about? I say, look, I'm sitting in the room with people, compassionate friends, you know, their children have died. And they're telling me that 5 years later, their child showed up and, you know, said, and again, I don't make up these stories. A woman's driving down the parkway. She hears her son say, Mom, slow down. And a bird lands in the road, so she had to slow down. The kind of bird, I think it was a seagull, that her son was very interested in. So she slows down, goes around the turn, and there's a sheet of ice with 20 or 30 cars piled up. And she said, if I didn't slow down, I'd been in the wreck. Now, see, my question to Brian is, wait a minute, her kid died 5 years ago. Well, I mean, why isn't he in another body by now and in kindergarten rather than, you know, showing up to help his mother? And Brian's answer always drove me nuts. There's no time. When you leave your body, time doesn't exist. And it took me a long time to buy that and understand it. And what helped me most was a line from the show Carousel, the musical, because a man is shot and killed during a robbery when he has an infant daughter. And the angel says to him, hey, you want to go back and see your daughter graduate from high school? And he says, my daughter's an infant. What are you talking about? And the angel says, this is Rodgers and Hammerstein's line. There's no time up here. Well, I'll tell you, when a creative person says that, you know, poets,
mm-hmm,
songwriters, so forth, artists of various sorts, yeah, then I buy the package. I accepted it.
I have to tell you the story, since you brought up the time and Brian, you know, talking to Brian. I have a 9-year-old, and well, I went through a dark night of the soul. My father died abruptly, and I got pregnant, and he didn't know it. And at the same time, I was converting from being a Southern Baptist to a conservative Jew. So my father never knew any of that stuff. So 7 years almost to the minute that my father dies, I have another child. And he comes, they induce my labor for 2 whole days and nothing happened. And when it gets 20 minutes after 6 on February the 5th, that baby comes out in less than 15 minutes. It just comes out. At the exact time, on the exact same date, as my father's death 7 years ago. And my rabbi said to me at this time, Eva, if a soul wishes to reincarnate, it can do so upon the expiration of 7 years.
Wow.
Then 9 months later, or 10 months later maybe, you know, a 10-month-old can't talk, you know, that they can't enunciate words and sentences. Well, my little boy and I were laying in the bed, and we were looking out the window. It was at night. We were just kind of laying there looking at the stars, and he said, I love no flat. And I was like, what? I love no flat. You know, I couldn't understand what. And finally, he took a deep breath and went, I love Norman Flack, and never uttered another word. Norman Flack was my father, and he never knew my father.
Wow.
He was dead 7 years before he was ever born. And he didn't talk for another, you know, year after that, probably, or however old the kids are when they talk, but he did that somehow.
Hmm.
I love Norman Flack. And he couldn't even talk, but he got that sentence out. Anyway, I just had to share that with you.
Yeah, because
you do get it. You understand.
Yeah, my comment to people always is, see, I would tell things to doctors about patients having all kinds of experiences. Because I did a lot of, again, about consciousness. From patients who are anesthetized, I would talk to them constantly during surgery. And they would wake up with an awareness of what was said to them. You know, it's almost like post-hypnotic suggestions,
mm-hmm,
you know what I mean? I would talk to them, suggest things to them, and they would act them out after the surgery was done. And which included, you know, helping them be more comfortable and hungry and things of this sort. They recover faster.
So I have another.
I forgot what I was. I mean, my mind is going from one thing to another.
So is mine. I'm struggling here. I have so many questions. I just.
But because you had said about your son, and then I don't know where I was going. But well, I've even had patients die in the operating room, and because of my work with Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, figure what have I got to lose? You know, if their spirit is still around. And I've said, it's not your time, come on back. And the guy's heart started again, and he recovered. And the anesthesiologist couldn't believe it. Yeah, this is what I was thinking about. See, but you tell that story to some doctor, and they say, I can't accept it. What I learned is, if I live the experience, I accept it, even if I can't explain it. And I'm often saying to doctors, look, you may say, I can't explain it, I can't understand how it happened. But don't say, I can't accept it, you know, because then, like quantum physicists or astronomers, they search for information. They don't say, oh, this is crazy. How could the universe be? I mean, they don't say, I can't accept the universe, even if they can't explain it or understand how it was created. So they explore. And as they learn, you know, to experience and accept. And I think we all need to keep our minds open to our experiences rather than close them and not want to see. And that's part of why, you know, medical school should be a real education, not just a bunch of information.
I have a question here. You don't hear voices, do you? You hear a voice, right? Or do you hear different voices?
No, it's always been, I don't know, maybe because I'm a male, it's always sounded like a male voice.
Uh-huh.
And as I say, a lot of times I say things, and I know it has, for instance, I walked into the room of a child who's dying of cystic fibrosis and never got a lung transplant. And he turned to me and he said, why am I different? And what he was pointing out was, there are kids in the street his age playing ball, and he's in the hospital dying. So he said, why am I different? And I immediately answered, because it makes you beautiful. And I know I didn't say that. I would never say that to a dying child. And I then started to apologize, and he looked at me with his beautiful smile on his face, and he loved the answer. Now, you know, I would never have said anything.
How long
like
have you, did you do that, Bernie? Did you do it from being a child?
No, it began to happen more after, again, starting the support groups, working with Elizabeth mm-hmm. Boomer-Ross, I mean, you know, Brian Weiss. I mean, so my mind began to open up. I wasn't closed-minded, refusing to accept things. I just let it go and let it happen.
Do you hear a high-pitched sound in your head? Like a high-pitched frequency?
Well, that I blame on my ear.
Oh, please don't. I have to tell you this. I had a spontaneous enlightenment. I want to say it's like a near-death experience if I didn't have to die. It happened in my sleep.
Mm-hmm.
But from that moment on, I had this high-pitched sound in my ears. So that's when I started doing this radio show, I started asking every single serious spiritual seeker or person that's serious about spirituality has that sound.
That's weird.
And Irvin Laszlo told me that it was, when I asked him, he said, Eva, it's B-flat. It's the sound of silence and hurt. It's the frequency that comes from a black hole, from the void. It's that sound that the original intention was placed upon to start, you know, atoms knocking together and bumping to form physical reality. So then Norm Shealy and I started talking about it, and we think maybe when your frequencies, when you get conscious, your resonance speeds up and you burn up more magnesium, and what happens? You get tinnitus.
You get what?
You know, you get that ringing in your ears when you have enough magnesium. So that's all I know to say. And when I did dinner for some Buddhist monks that came through town, from some Tibetan monks that came through town not too long ago. When we sat down at the table, all of us, it went up an octave and turned up the volume, and all of us got that sound at the same time. It's like when two or more gather. So you have that sound. I knew you would have that sound.
That's interesting.
I knew you would have that sound.
I assumed, you know, from ear infections or something, you know, that because one audiogram, you know, where they're testing your hearing,
uh-huh.
that tone. See, I don't know if I ever have another one. I'll ask them what tone it is. In other words, you're hearing fine, and then suddenly it had to get louder for me to hear it, because it had to get louder than the sound I was already hearing.
Yes,
so it showed up on an audiogram.
Well, go on to what I did when Irvin told me it was B flat. I went on the computer and I found a site that where you can play the tones of particular notes,
right.
And it was B flat. I was just amazed.
I'll play the piano. I'm not a pianist, but I'll plink away at that too. See, what
you know, go on the computer where you know right. that your sound is pure right. and it's on the right note.
Yeah. Also, you mentioned silence. The one time in my life I was in total silence. Was on a sand dune in Cape Cod where there was no wind, no airplanes, nobody. My wife and I were out biking, you know, off season, and we're in the middle of nowhere, and we stopped riding, and there was no sound at all. And I thought my head was going to explode. Because I mean, I literally say to people, the loudest sound you can ever hear is silence.
Yes, it is.
It's just incredibly overwhelming to be in total silence. I could tolerate it today because I've matured and learned, but this was years ago. I jumped back on the bike and started moving to make sound and wind because I couldn't handle silence.
That's interesting. So I want to ask you another question. Have you noticed whether or not particular emotional problems cause particular cancers? Like when that thing happened to me, I got medical intuitive abilities, and I never even thought about this until that happened. But
well,
I noticed... I'm sorry.
Go ahead, finish.
I noticed that about 7 out of 10 people had been touched inappropriately by caregivers, and out of that 7, 5 of them, the women would get breast cancer and the men would get testicular cancer or prostate cancer. Have you noticed that it's disease-specific?
There are several things that... I mean, so much to tell you that years ago, Caroline Thomas, the psychiatrist at Johns Hopkins, asked the medical students to draw a picture of themselves and to fill out a personality profile. Her assumption was that cancer would be a control group, that it would have nothing to do with emotions. And she changed her opinion in two ways. She said a low closeness to parent profile makes people more likely to develop cancer. It's part of what you're saying.
What does that mean, Lope?
Well, I mean, you don't have a good relationship with your
parents. Okay.
That was her psychiatric terminology, a low closeness to parent profile. So when you're looking at the forms they fill out, they have a poor relationship with their parents. And the other was, she said, I could tell what part of the body they would get cancer in by the way they drew their bodies, which part was vulnerable. Now, I was getting criticized for all of this, and then I run across her, and she tells me all that. It was like, wow.
What was her name?
And an example also was your personality predicts what type of disease you'll have. For instance, if people didn't draw hands or had their hands hidden, they were more likely to have emotional problems. And my interpretation is if you can't reach out, get a grip on things, you're going to have problems, see? The people who had their arms way out apart were more likely to have heart trouble, like your heart is vulnerable. And the people who drew their arms in two different positions, which she called ambivalent, were more likely to develop cancer. Now, the other thing that isn't told in medical school, Carl Jung, maybe 90 or so years ago, interpreted a dream. Part of the dream was that there was a milky pond that was obstructed. Now, he related it to an area of the brain called the mammillary bodies, which are like two mounds so that can remind of a breast, and the cerebrospinal fluid being blocked. And he went on and he diagnosed a brain tumor correctly from a dream. No medical student has ever told that. Because of Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's background in Jungian therapy, I began to work with drawings. I mean, partly because she, after looking at a little outdoor scene I drew, said to me, what are you covering up? I said, what are you talking about? She said, you made snow on a mountain. I said, yes, a mountain with snow. She said, Bernie, the page is white. You took a white crayon and added a layer. So what are you covering up? And I told her about my pain. And then she said, why is 12 important? I said, I've been doing this 12 months. And by the time she was done, it was like, I can't believe this. I sketch a little picture that means nothing to me, and look what it is selling her. So I began to work with patients' dreams and drawings. And literally, the body communicates through dreams and drawings. So I can diagnose disease from a patient's drawing, as well as some people waking up and knowing what their disease is.
What if they're not artistic? They just draw stick. What if they just draw like a stick man or something? They're not artistic.
It isn't how they draw. See, that's when we get back to guilt, shame, and blame. I say to people, draw a picture. I'm not an artist. Have my 10-year-old son do it for me. That's the sad part. Say, you have cancer and you're afraid to draw a picture? So it's the unconscious that produces it. In other words, I will draw pictures for people, trying to make sure they know we got a great family, and be amazed when I notice two of the kids aren't holding hands. And I set out to make it look excellent and perfect, and, you know, and the unconscious blinds you. So believe me, it isn't about being an artist. It's about what comes. See, even a bloodstream can be a stream of water. But if you know anatomy, you look at it and say, oh, look, that's the heart blood vessel. A tree can be drawn so it looks like a brain with all the folds. I mean, these are just simple examples. And I show a lot of them when I lecture. And people go, oh. Or even a boat where the sails look like breasts. You know, it's very obvious to people. You don't need to be a doctor to look at it. And if I say, where does this person have a problem, everybody makes the correct diagnosis. So there's a lot of inner wisdom. See, again, I try to get across to people, your intellect makes decisions. See, what's good for you? But you need to get in touch with your intuition. There's two sources of wisdom within us. One is the thinking part, the other is the intuitive or unconscious part. If they don't agree with each other, you are going to have a hell of a lot of trouble with any treatment or decision you make. See, because if one says they're poisoning me and abusing me, and the other one says this is what I want to do, you're going to have inner conflict and difficulties. Now, let me take one moment also so people understand how powerful your mind is. An X-ray machine is repaired, radiation therapy. A month later, they're doing a routine inspection again, and they realize nobody ever put the radiation material back in the machine. So it has no radioactive material, and they were treating people for a month. When the radiation therapist told me that, I said, don't you understand what you're telling me? He said, well, I'm telling you about this terrible mistake. I said, no, what you're telling me is that you'd have to be an idiot to not realize you hadn't treated anybody for an entire month. I said, it's obvious to me that you thought you were treating people because their tumors were shrinking, their skin was getting red, they were having other side effects. And he said, oh, my God, you're right. Yes, people thought they were being treated and responded as if they were. And that's why I've learned to what I call deceive people into help. In other words,
You're beautiful, Bernie.
Hypnotic techniques, and even lying, especially to kids, because they believe me. When I say lying, I'm not doing anything terrible. You know, I can walk in with a bottle of vitamins, tell a child, don't worry, your hair won't fall out when you get chemotherapy. This is a hair-growing pill. And, you know, they believe you. Or rubbing them with an alcohol sponge before you put a needle in to draw blood, and I'll say, hey, we got a new pad here. It numbs the skin. And a third of the kids tell you, oh, boy, why don't the other doctors use that? Thank you. And the others will say, no, it didn't work very well. It still hurt. But they're seeing it in a different way. Their emotional state has changed, and they have far less pain. And one more line that, see, part of what woke me up, again, was not me trying all this, but having things happen. I would tell children in the emergency room, we're going up to the operating room. You'll go to sleep when you go into the operating room. What am I thinking about? That they'll be anesthetized, and I don't want them to fear that they'll have surgery and feel anything. And I noticed that kids were falling asleep as I wheeled them into the room on the stretcher that we were wheeling them on. You'd wheel them through the door, and boom, they were out. And it was absolutely incredible. I mean, some of them got mad at me for waking them up, because one boy, it was humorous, he flipped over and went to sleep, and he had appendicitis. So I turned him back over, put him on the operating table. He said, what are you doing? I said, I have to operate. He said, you told me I'd sleep, and I sleep on my stomach. That's how literally these kids took it. I mean, he, you know, when I told him I can't get to his appendix, he said, all right, I'll sleep on my back. But, I mean, that impressed me. And I would say the work of Milton Erickson, psychiatrist and hypnotherapist, verifies so much of this. because his techniques and, as he would say, my voice will go with you, and what he would induce in patients to help them.
Pretty, when I called you, how are you? So
yeah.
You're conscious that you struggle daily, too. What do you do with
yeah,
that?
Yeah, well, I mean, my wife has had a long history of multiple sclerosis, going back about 40, 45 years, and it taught me, because she gave birth, which included twins, to 5 children in 7 years. I ended up in the hospital with an infection. She ended up coming down with MS, and I realized the two of us are exposed to an incredibly stressful time where we're only sleeping a few hours every night taking care of all these kids. You know, this is in an age when you didn't have, you know, disposable items. So you were formula, diapers. I mean, you were going nuts day and night. And I realized you can't separate your life from your health. And she has some problems now. I mean, she has, believe me, far exceeded everybody's expectations. So I learned about alternative therapy, complementary therapy, doing a lot of things. So she's still here and around. But her energy and her strength are not that good. So, you know, I love her, and I become the caregiver. And being a doctor is a pain in the butt at times because you're always trying to fix everything. And that's not what's needed, if you know what I mean. What's needed is more compassion and love and assistance and not trying to find a solution to everything. So I keep learning every day.
How do your kids deal with the different kind of father?
None of them are doctors, and I think that was because their decision-making time was when I was struggling with medicine. So I think they saw my struggle and thought, this is not something I want to do. Today, I think they feel very differently because they see how I'm helping people and caring for people. So, yeah, they've been my teachers also and my guides. So a lot of what I write, whether it's the 365 prescriptions or, 355, yeah, prescriptions for the soul. I've written prescriptions for living and a whole host of other books. They are often included in it because what I've learned from them about life.
How do they accept you hearing the voice?
Well,
kids need me to be normal, and the other one need me to be weird.
Yeah,
so
they think I'm a little strange, but, you know, as Jung said, seeking to be normal is only, you know, satisfying for those who are inadequate to begin with. So I've never been quite normal. See, I've always had a sense of humor. And again, that comes from that inner child who was loved. So I wasn't worried about what others thought. And it drove them crazy from day one. And I always say, save me a lot of money. Because, I mean, a simple example, if I go to a restaurant with them, you know, we'd be in a Chinese restaurant, and the waiter would come over, and I'd order Italian food. And, you know, it would upset the kids, I mean, the crazy father. So after a while, they'd stop eating out, and I saved a lot of money, especially with 5 kids. And he'd say, Mom and I are going out to eat. You want to come? No, we'll have what's in the refrigerator. But, you see, what happens? This happened with 2 of them, one at school, one at work. They came home and said, hey, Dad, I want to thank you. I said, for what? They said, I did something that was, you know, upsetting to people at work today or at school today, and I didn't get punished. I heard people saying, well, you know who his father is. So they began to realize there was a benefit to having a father who embarrassed them. When they did something, I got blamed for it. So then they were thankful that they did not have a normal father because I was their excuse. And I mean it.
Sorry.
That was so funny to have that happen. Say, thank you, Dad.
You got 5 minutes. What would you like to talk about that we haven't already?
Well, there's a book called The Human Comedy by William Saroyan. It's one of my favorite books. For several reasons. One is a line that says, the best part of a good man stays forever, for love is immortal and makes all things immortal, but hate dies every minute. And it takes place in World War II, and the boy's brother is killed in the war, and he hears that. And I say to people, if you want to live forever, love somebody. The only thing of permanence is love. The other is a line from another story by Saroyan called The Man... on the flying trapeze. A young man is starving to death. He has no money and lies down on his bed. And there's a description of how he leaves his body. But the last three words in that story are, he becomes dreamless, unalive, perfect. That really hit me because I've seen that with drawings. Patients who have colostomies, amputated limbs, suddenly draw themselves perfect again. And I knew they're telling me, I'm leaving my body and I'll be perfect again. And one book, you know, as I mentioned this earlier, called Mindsight by Ken Ring, people who were born blind, he collected near-death experiences and how they see when they're out of their body. So I would say to people, death is not the worst outcome. Noah had the problem. He had to survive. He had, as many clergy have said to me, had the boatload of manure. You know, that's life. But when you understand how to use the darkness and turn it into a diamond, then your life really becomes very different. And I'd say that we're here to love in our fashion and to not be afraid of leaving our body. So I can literally say that I'm not afraid of anything. I used to be afraid of being bitten by a dog, and I was, and hey, I managed that too. So, you know,
it doesn't hurt to die, does it?
Yeah. No, it wasn't as bad as I thought.
No,
and,
I mean, it doesn't hurt.
Oh, and the funny part, you know, see, maybe God was teaching me a lesson. I'm running down the street. This dog comes charging out of the yard where there's a big sign, beware of the dog. I'm yelling at the man who's in the yard. The dog comes up and bites me. And, I called the police because the dog had rabies shot, you know. And I get a call back from the lawyer for this man who said, I'm sorry, but the man is totally deaf, and he didn't hear you yelling, get your dog. Well, at that point, I burst out laughing. I mean, how could I be angry at a deaf man for not hearing me yell, get your dog? But that's the kind of things that happen to me and teach me lessons. But I think, as I said, that we're here to love. And if you want to die laughing, then experience love and know that you have accomplished what we're all sent here to accomplish. And I was just reading something. Mahatma Gandhi said, let your life be your message. So I'd say live the sermon and keep the child in you alive so that you will always have that sense of humor and be able to make it through the day.
Wow. Thank you, Bernie. You're a
Thank
wonderful
you.
Interview. Thank you.
Well, you helped. I mean, I know I did a lot of talking, but it's like your energy brought it out. So I didn't have trouble going on. Thank you.
You're such a pleasure. Please come back.
I will. Invite me. I will.
I'm going to.
The things, because I felt safe talking to you. And as I said, if people want to get in touch, BernieSiegelMD.com.
Thank you and good night.
Bless you. Bye-bye.
You, bye-bye.
Hi, this is Elliot Dasher, author of Integral Health.
Integral Health.
You can hear me and others speaking about consciousness and health. Just tune in every Sunday evening at 7 p.m. to Infinite Consciousness with Eva Herr.